You recognize that human nature means that we pick up some pretty disgusting habits. I apologize for even this morning reminding you of some of those, but they're just so common. It doesn't matter where you live, there are just some nasty habits that people have. You don't have to be in a crowd very long before you won't begin to notice that some, most likely a guy, and again, cut me a little slack here, but he's very likely to pull into his pocket and pull out a set of keys, and he may start cleaning his ears with his keys in public. I mean, you're not exactly shocked when you see that. It happens often enough. You recognize other disgusting habits we have. Another one is that you sit down at a table and you accidentally let your hand brush the bottom of the table. And it's like it has warts because somebody has kindly left you their gum in case you wanted to use it yourself later. And the bottom of tables covered with that, and you're thinking, oh, what a nasty habit to have. There are other nasty habits that you would find. There isn't any doubt that we're in Southwest Missouri. Every other vehicle in the parking lot at times looks like it has either a Pepsi can or a Coke can that's sitting on the dash. And it isn't Pepsi and it isn't Coke. No, it's Spittoon that the man or woman, in which case, may have, and she's, you know, setting it back. Welcome to Southwest Missouri. A rather disgusting habit that you just simply recognize. And again, isn't this a bright, cheery way to start a sermon? Actually, there's a nastier habit that probably all of us struggle with. And some not only struggle, but let's be honest, some really fail. There's a nastier habit that is pretty pervasive within human nature. I want you to turn, if you wouldn't mind, to the book of Exodus. We'll be in Psalms eventually when we get there. But Psalm 15, or Exodus 15, is where I want you to go first. It's pointed out so clearly, and I think it's so obvious how wrong it is in the book of Exodus that you can see it there. In Exodus, you have the nation of Israel that's just been escorted by God with a cloud or a pillar of fire out of Egypt. And as they're escorted by God, they walk across the Red Sea on dry land. That would have been quite a kick. Walk across on dry land and you see the waters piled up on left and right-hand side of you, and God's held them out. You've been delivered by God's mighty hand. Exodus 15 has the song of praise and celebration. And before the chapter's over, notice this key word, verse 24. So the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What are we to drink?" And all at once we hit a word that just doesn't seem to go away. The word grumble. Look at chapter 16. Verse 2, in the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses, and the word starts there. And look over, if you wouldn't mind, verse 8, the word grumble. In fact, Moses says, "You're not grumbling against us, but against the Lord." Then Moses told Aaron, "Say to the entire community, come before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling." You come down to verse 11. The Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them." And then if we just keep turning pages, chapter 17, you're going to notice probably the second verse. So they quarreled with Moses. It's the same word, grumble concept. One of the natures of being a human is that when my soul is sick and not well, I will deteriorate into a complainer and a grumbler. I'll be somebody whose sense of everything just is not quite right, and I notice that it's just not right. The service wasn't fast enough. The cars in the parking lot park stupid. The whatever it is, on and on and on and on. Being around a grumbler is an exhausting experience. Oh, my goodness. You talk about just beat you down. A grumbler walks into a room, and when a complainer walks into a room, they just suck all the light out of the room. I mean, I don't care how many lights are in the room. 100-watt light bulbs may fill the ceiling, but it'll just grow dim because of 1,000 paper cuts they inflict on people. In fact, that is a phrase that I think is probably accurate. The grumbler bleeds people to death with 1,000 paper cuts. Just constantly hemorrhaging from the little things. And as soon as I start talking, I recognize this is a sermon where I, when I introduce this idea, some of you are sitting there going, boy, I hope my 14-year-old boy hears this. Boy, my 14-year-old boy needs to hear this because, and somebody else is thinking, boy, I hope my 28-year-old husband would hear this. And somebody else is thinking, and the list goes on. I want to remind you, it's more than a personality trait. It's much more than a personality trait. In fact, I don't know that it is a personality trait. It's a character trait. When Paul wrote to the Corinthians, and he goes through the list of things that are offensive to God, he mentions things like sexual immorality. We'd say, yeah, I understand that one. He mentions idolatry, and we're going, yeah, I understand that one. And he puts grumbling right in the middle of it. Grumbling. Grumbling is a form of idolatry, for the most part, that takes a look at my world is not the way I wish my world were, and I will tell you, I will let you know. It's a sickness of the soul. Grumblers. I believe, quite frankly, it is ungodly. I think it's demonic. I believe it's extremely harmful. I preached this sermon the first hour, and the first couple of hours, and last night. But a guy walked up to me and said, boy, he said, now it's clear. When I grumble, I'll go to hell. Well, you know what? I don't know that he's that far off. And I'll tell you why as we get further into this. Let me contrast that. The nation of Israel was known as grumblers. Contrast that with the other alternative. Look, for example, at Philippians, the book of Philippians, and we'll turn back to the fourth chapter really briefly on it. In the book of Philippians, you have a guy like Paul who has a situation that is similar. I mean, the nation of Israel is being led by God, and they're off in the wilderness. Paul's led by God, but it leads him through prison, and he is in prison when he writes this book. But it's a book that's written nothing like Exodus. It doesn't sound like Exodus. It has a whole different flavor from Exodus. The book of Philippians is a sense of rejoice and a sense of things that give me pleasure and a sense of things that are right. Oh, he has concerns in the book of Philippians, and you'll find them, but you find Philippians has such a different tone to it. And the reason being is that Paul has a different heart than the Egyptians have. And the question on this matter of grumbling and complaining and all those sort of things that we do within our own hearts, do I have more of the Paul's heart or the more of the Israelite heart in the book of Exodus? Which one do I have? Paul says things in Philippians 4, for example, rejoice in the Lord always. I'll say it again, rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all. I hadn't really thought till I was looking at this passage earlier how the word gentleness is such a contrast to the concept of grumbling and how the word gentleness fits in with the concept of rejoice. I normally wouldn't put gentleness and rejoice in the same sentence, but that's what he does. He ties them together. Gentleness and rejoicing are wed together. He comes down in here and he says all kinds of things. The Lord is near. He said the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. There's something happening in Paul's heart that is different than the Israelites. He says, whatever is, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, think on these things. He then gives his own testimony and says, in verses 11 through 13, he says, I've learned to be content in every circumstance. I've been in situations where I've been in want. I've been in situations where I've had plenty. And I've learned to be content in both of those. And he describes something that God wants in every human heart. Something that escapes the cancer of the grumbling complainer. And somebody who has a sense of rejoice and contentment. Turn, if you wouldn't mind, to the book of Psalms. Psalm 100. I believe that Psalm 100 will give us insights on how to think differently. I think Psalm 100, it's not the only psalm, it's just one of a series of psalms, but it is a psalm that will move me from being an Israelite to being a Paul. And I think if we'll practice what we're instructed to do out of Psalm 100, I think you'll become a breath of fresh air, not only to the heart of the Lord, but I think you'll become a breath of fresh air to your husband or your wife or to your parents or to your boss. I believe there is something that happens in Psalm 100 that would help us begin to learn to think differently. Let's go through it. It goes like this. Shout for joy to the Lord, all the earth. Worship the Lord with gladness. come before Him with joyful songs. Know that the Lord is God, and that it is He who made us, and we are His. We are His people, the sheep of His pasture. Enter His gates with thanksgiving and His courts with praise. Give thanks to Him and praise His name. For the Lord is good, and His love endures forever. His faithfulness continues through all generations. If I had a way that I think it sort of causes us to change our thinking differently, I would say that verses 1 and 2, it gives instructions on here's what you can do that will cause you to think differently. Here's what you can do in verses 1 and 2 to cause you to think differently. In verse 3, I think he says, here's why you can do those things. And then I think in verses 4 and 5, he'll give you an invitation. Come join me in doing these things. And so verses 1 and 2, here's what you can do. Verse 3, here's why. Verses 4 and 5, an invitation. Let's start in with verse 1. What can I do to begin to think differently? Verse 1. Shout for joy to the Lord. There are 7 imperatives in this Psalm 100, 7 action words, 7 imperatives. And the first one is the word shout. It's the word that means celebrate. Celebrate for joy to the Lord. It's an imperative that He gives. Now, that's pretty easy to do if your world is in pretty good shape. To shout for joy is not difficult if you propose to the girl and she said yes. It's not difficult if the baby was born and has 10 fingers and 10 toes and crying like a healthy baby. It's not difficult to shout for joy when you're driving down the driveway, headed on vacation, and the leaky roof is behind you, and I'm just leaving, I'm going away on vacation. Shouting for joy is not difficult. But how do you shout for joy when life is just what life is? How do you shout for joy when the boss is breathing down your neck? How do you shout for joy when the kids have left 40 jillion things on the floor, and it's not just that they leave things on the floor, but they don't care about your heart and how you care about them leaving things on the floor? How do you shout for joy when the teacher gives a month worth of assignments and they're all due by 8 in the morning? I mean, how do you shout for joy on all of those things? Well, I want to take a second and just notice what it does not say. It does not say in this text, shout for happiness. I don't want to play semantics too long, but I think it is worth at least stopping here for a second. There is a distinct difference between happiness and joy. Just the background of the English word happy, it comes out of the core word for that which happens. The English word hap, having to do with that which happens to us. And happiness is the result of having things happen to us that will make us happy. But we all have things that happen to us that don't make us happy, so how do you have joy? Joy is a more transcendent concept. It's not about what has just happened to me. Joy is about a broader picture. It's about more transcendent concept. Joy is about the things that are more unshakable. Let me use an illustration. Paul and Silas go into the city of Philippi, and when they get into Philippi, a bad thing begins to happen in their world, and that bad thing simply is the Greek language says they were severely beaten. And the word severely is a pretty strong word. Severely beaten, illegally grabbed. The text says they're thrown into the prison and their feet put in stocks. So now you have beaten people whose feet are in stocks in a Roman prison. What just happened is not too bright and shiny. But the text says, but they begin to pray and begin to sing hymns of praise, or the concept of hymns of praise to the Lord. And the next thing you know, all the prisoners are stopping to listen as they sing or celebrate with joy. How did that happen? Well, the answer is that they made a decision that I'm not going to look at just what has happened. If I only look at what has happened, then there's no doubt about it. Then all that you can sometimes have is tears. That's all you can have. But I don't want to look at what just has happened. I want to look at a broader picture. And I don't know how they looked at the broader picture. Maybe it began with their simply praying, oh, God, we need you. God, we need you to rescue us. God, you're going to need to do something here. And then it maybe began to be broadened when they said, and Father, thank you for what you've done in the past. And maybe they began to recite. I don't know what they began to recite, how God had been good to them in the past. But somehow, what happened to them began to broaden out into a broader picture. They had no idea God was going to suddenly shake a prison in its foundation by an earthquake. But somehow, they had an idea that God could do those kinds of things, and that God had been merciful, and God was good. Notice the end of the text, that God is good, and God is loving, and God is trustworthy. And so, instead of just what happened, it broadened out. And the next thing you know, out of their praise, God moves, and the very jailer who probably supervised their beating is falling on his knees in front of them saying, how do we be saved? And you recognize something significant that takes place. Grumblers and complainers have a heart that stays on what happens. It's a narrow, myopic view. And people that have joy have a broader picture of a God who's good and a God who's merciful, and it doesn't explain away what's just happened. But what just happened has a context. I'm being pretty transparent, but about 3 weeks ago, Julie will tell you the same thing, but I had a bummer of a week. It just was a week that I just was... everything that I recognized in my own heart was even turning a darker shade that I wanted to. There was no particular thing. It wasn't anything. There was no particular culprit out there. There wasn't any villain I could put it on. But every time I looked up, I found myself with a moodiness. And I mentioned this a couple weeks ago in a sermon, just a little bit about it. It was a moodiness that I recognized. And in that moodiness, the thing that I recognized was that I myself was doing the exact same thing the Corinthians were doing, which was a form of idolatry, which gets to form, that you're unhappy on the things that are just occurring around you. And the way that I knew I had to respond, because it's just biblical, the imperative is shout for joy. I don't care what mood you're in. And for me, the way I did it's pretty simple. I set a chair out beside my desk, which I will still do with some regularity. And again I said, Lord, I know you can't sit in this chair. The whole universe can't contain you. But I'm in the presence of God. And God, there is something, I didn't say Israelite-like, but that's what the book of Exodus. There's something Israelite happening in my own heart that I don't like. And I know you don't like it. And God, what I want to do is I want to remind my own heart, and I want to tell you again how you've been good to me through the years. And I took a pencil and I just began to write out all the ways the Lord has been good and the Lord has been loving and the Lord has been merciful in my life. And obviously it had things like Julie's name in it and had my kid's name in it and had co-workers' name in it and it had this church and had people. But it had to do with forgiveness of sins. It had to do with changes in my life. It had to do with biblical promises that I stand on. And by page 2, what had maybe started out as a reluctant exercise became almost a hilarious one. It became a sense of how unfaithful I am to be a grumbler or a complainer when the happenings of my life are not what I want, but the scope of my life, I couldn't ask for anything better. The Israelite nation in Egypt, or coming out of Egypt, was this. Be around any one of us that has a heart that is a grumbler, complainer, and you'll recognize we have violated this imperative of celebrate to the Lord the things that cause joy. There's a second imperative in there. The second imperative is worship the Lord with gladness. Now, we could take the word worship and play with that, and that's the right word, but I'm going to make it a little more narrow. I'm going to bring that one in a little tighter. The word worship in that verse is actually the Hebrew word for serve. Serve the Lord. If you want to think differently, celebrate with joy what you before the Lord, and if you really want to change your thinking, serve the Lord with gladness. Serve the Lord with gladness. Now, I want to take a very narrow, specific application, but how do you serve the Lord? How do you really serve the Lord? Is, in fact, serving the Lord, does it have a way I can put my hands around it? I think a great key is in Matthew 25, where Jesus said, "Those of you who did anything to the least of these, thank you. You served me. Those of you who did anything to the lonely and the strangers, thank you. You served me. Those of you who took good care of those who were in prison and you went and visited them, thank you. You served me. Those of you who took care of the sick, thank you, you serve me." And the concept, I believe, in this, how do I change my thinking, I think has something to do with go and serve the Lord, has to do with Jesus' concept that if you really want to serve me, choose someone that you begin to have a talent base in ministry with. I think that's exactly what Matthew 25 is saying, and I'm pulling it a little tighter in this text, I realize that. But if I'm going to change my thinking, celebrate what I have to be joyful about and serve Him by taking care of least people. That's certainly one of the ways. We did a memorial service yesterday here for a lady named Marie Mann. Marie Mann was a 90-year-old woman that most of you would not have known. She kind of outlived most of her contemporaries. Marie Mann was as common as an old shoe. Marie Mann had one of the most joyful lives. She was content, never spoke an ill word about anybody. In nearly every circumstance, there was something good she had to say about it. And she was a woman who honestly enjoyed life, had more pleasure just out of the simple things of life anybody can think of. Just enjoyed life. She was the epitome of a Paul in the Philippian jail. She would content and joyful, not a worrier. Now, when I trace it back and say, how did that happen? And I want to be careful with this. I no way do I want to speak disparagingly, but I want you to know she didn't have a circumstance that automatically generated it. She went to nurse's school when she was a kid, but she got spiral meningitis and couldn't pass it, almost died. So she didn't finish nursing school, so she never had a salary her whole life that would have been a high enough salary, really. She ended up running nursing homes for people who couldn't afford care, who didn't have families that could look after them very well, and she took care of old, abandoned people. She had a divorce that occurred. She had a husband who didn't share all the same spiritual values. Her family had reasons for her to be great heart in her family, but there were also heartaches in her own family. She was a woman that had the normal things of life, but she was a breath of fresh air to be around. Why? The answer is easily found. As in memorial service yesterday, we set a microphone out and simply said, had people just get up and say things. And it was like Dorcas in the book of Acts as people stood up. You need to know Acts 9 to know that story. Rick Bushnell walked up and said, when our family, I had these little old kids, it was Marie who had put $20 in our hand and asked me to take my wife and my kids out to go eat a meal. He said, we never went out, but Marie was the one who did that. And then he told other stories. Linda Crable got up and Linda said, when we first started Cooks and Hills, we went to public speaking and she said, I was embarrassed that I didn't have clothes good enough to wear in public to go speak to these churches. And it was Marie who somehow found out and took me and bought me full wardrobes that I could go in front of churches and go speak and not be embarrassed. It was Paul Butler got up and, oh, the iron marshmallow, Paul Butler. Paul Butler got up, and Paul, with tears that he could hardly speak, he said, it was Marie Mann who wrote me notes of encouragement, telling me what a good teacher and thanking me for my teaching. And it was Julie leaning over to me and whispering, do you remember when Marie brought us the VCR? She thought, our kids, do you remember when? And one by one by one, remember the old woman she always brought to church? Remember this, remember this. And what you had in Marie was a very plain old shoe kind of gal. but she washed the feet of Jesus through other people. And that woman had joy and contentment. Most every complainer, most every sour heart is an individual who you take a look at their hands, they don't have wrinkled hands from the towel in the basin. You find the complainer. And the complainer may hold biblical doctrine right. They may even teach or maybe do public kinds of things. But most every complainer will not have wrinkled hands from the towel in the basin. How do you change your thinking? I believe you start with the simple concept of I will celebrate the things I have for joy and I will serve the Lord with gladness. There's a third thing in this text, a third imperative. Come before Him with joyful songs. Come before Him with joyful songs. Coming before Him with joyful songs is, I think, pretty significant that you learn the skill of worshiping. And this text gives in particular a word, come before Him, has the Hebrew word face. It has to do to come to His face with joyful songs. Have you come to the place that your worship is face to face with God? If you've never learned to how to have personal and public worship where your worship is face to face with God, you'll struggle with a heart that turns sour. I apologize for what I'm about to do, but I guess I don't apologize enough. I'm not going to do it. I need this section right here, this section right here. Would you mind getting up and getting on the stage as much as you can? I apologize, but I need you to get up on the stage or close to it if you don't mind. If this whole section right here, thank you very much. This whole section. Todd, please don't sing, but we're going to put you right up here. Everybody up here. Now you're safe. You have to recite no verses. There's nothing that you have. I mean, you're safe. Please trust me. Yeah, and you can get close to the stage. Just you don't have to get exactly on it. But here it is. Now, I would love to clear the whole audience out. I mean, I'd love to have every single one of you. And if we had time, I would do this. I would ask every single person and we would put you up there. Because there's a visual problem that we have with worship. By the very nature of how rooms are established for worship and how we do it, we forget who the audience is. In fact, the most natural thing in the world is to set up chairs and believe we're the audience. I mean, I sat on those the same way. I'm the audience. And we have a stage. And the stage is those who lead the worship, and they lead the worship for we, the audience. In fact, there's sometimes you go home and say, man, they didn't know who their audience was very well. I didn't like how they picked out the songs. I didn't like those songs. Boy, they should have done. No, I didn't know the audience better. There's other Sundays that you think to yourself, gee whiz, that preacher, good grief. Does he not know who his audience is? We don't like that kind of preaching, those sort of things. And yes, sometimes he does know that. But what happens is we have this mental confusion on what's taking place. What's taking place in worship, in corporate worship and in private worship, is hindered by the confusion of the room. If we were doing this right, we ought to have some morning that you came in and there weren't chairs on the floor. That instead, every chair in this room were picked up and put off. And that all was in the room, in the middle of the room, sat one chair. And everybody who walked in went and stood on the stage. And the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, He who said, I'll never leave you, never abandon you, never forsake you, He who said, I will be with you always, He sits in the only chair in the audience, and everybody else is on the stage, and everybody else, you may listen to a few prompters who help whisper some of the words to us of the lines we'd like to say. And so the prompters may help us, but it is face to face with the Lord. The person who learns to worship the Lord face to face, that person will have a change of heart immensely. Worship that he's describing in this chapter 100 is the concept of I want you to shout to God. I want you to celebrate all the things you have to be joyful about. I want you to serve the Lord with gladness. And then he uses, I want you to come face to face. I realize, I no way do I want to ever turn a chair into idolatry. But it is not a hard thing for me to imagine that if I'd set a chair in front of Josh, and this entire worship service had been conducted with a single chair sitting in front of Josh, and I had said, Josh, I want you to sing not to the room. I don't want you to sing where Denise hears you. I don't want you to sing except to the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, your Creator and your Redeemer, the God who is good, the God who is merciful, and the God who is trustworthy. I want you to have face to face. I'm willing to bet that the song service and the very communion would impact Josh in different ways. Not that Josh has not already learned that, by the way. But the sudden recollection of face to face changes everything. And in this Hebrew text, he says, you want to have a change of heart? Shout for joy. Serve the Lord with gladness. And you come before his face with singing. I don't do it all the time. I probably do it a couple of times a week. But I will pull a chair out beside my desk. And I will say, God, forgive me for having lost the concept for how close and intimate I am in your presence. May I worship you face to face. You may be seated. Somehow, everyone who begins to get a different thinking goes that route. There's so much more in this text. I'm going to need to quit here. Let me just simply go into verse 3. He said, here's why you can do all those things. The Lord is God. It is He who made us. We are His people. We're the sheep of His pasture. You know what a relief and freeing thing that is? If you honestly understand who He is, you understand who you are. Years ago, my dad sent me to a field with an instrument called a swather. It's a piece of machinery. It's a lot like a combine, only it doesn't thrash the grain. It just takes it and rolls it all together and puts it in rows out in the field. So sometimes when you see rows of fescue or something, a swather has cut it and put it in rows. Dad sent me to a field with a swather, and it didn't go well. Things didn't go well. The swather was old, and it had canvas, and the canvas that's supposed to roll the grain wasn't doing it right, and had a bearing that was giving me trouble. And I remember just being so frustrated at what was happening. My life that day was a real bear, trying to get that swather to work right. And I was so frustrated. I also knew I felt like such a great failure, such a massive failure that day. Just can't get it to work. My dad came driving in the pickup somewhere that afternoon. And when Dad came in, he knew how frustrated I was. I mean, I just was almost to the point of tears as a little kid, probably. Remember my dad, one of the best things my dad ever did. Dad looked at me in the face and he said, Randy, are you where I sent you? I said, yes, sir. Randy, are you doing what I ask you to do? Yes, sir. Then, Randy, all those problems you're carrying are not your problems. They're mine. Those aren't your problems. You went where I sent you. You were doing what I ask. All these problems are not your problems. They're mine. So how do you shout for joy in the middle of life when you have the alcoholic husband? And how do you do it when there's hard things that happen? And the answer is, well, I look for the joy, which is a bigger picture than what happens. I serve the Lord with gladness. I worship Him face to face. And I know this. The pressure's off me. Randy, are you being holy? Yes, sir. I'm devoting my heart to it. I need more, but no, I'm devoting my heart to it. Randy, are you serving? I'm trying. I'm trying to get... Then, Randy, all these other things you're so worried about, let me be the shepherd and you be the sheep. Let me be the creator and you be mine. The last part of this says, here's the only thing I want from you. Julie and every wife here, you're buying gifts like crazy for graduates, and you're buying gifts like crazy for weddings, and you're always thinking, is this, Julie will walk out with regularity and say, you think this is all right to give them? You think this is all right to give them? How do you know it's the right thing to give to the Lord? And the Lord whispers, here's the only thing I want. I want you to come in my gates with thanksgiving. I want you to come into my courts with praise. That's all I want. Jesus one time healed 10 lepers and they all ran off, but one came back and Jesus said, where are the other 9? And the one, that's what I want to be. I want to be the leper who came back with gratitude and praise. So you tell me how I can live the life of a grumbler and a complainer. You tell me how I can inflict a million paper cuts on people around me. You tell me how I can live like an Israelite out of the book of Exodus. May my heart be changed. May yours as well.